Coming up, you will hear Japanese-Canadian author Hiromi Goto reading and discussing her work at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival in July 2017. Ms. Goto has written many books for youth and adults, including a forthcoming graphic novel, and has received major awards in Canada and abroad. In this program, she reads first from her recently reissued 2014 debut novel, A Chorus of Mushrooms, and then from her youth fiction. She is introduced by the man who translated A Chorus of Mushrooms.
Good afternoon. My name is Matsuki Masutani, and I live on Denman Island for 30 years. I was chosen to introduce Hiromi Goto-san because I translated her first book several years ago, Mushroom, A Chorus of Mushroom. She will read it from there tonight, this afternoon. And the book won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for the best first book, the Canada-Japan Book Award, and the recommendation by the Japanese Library Associations. Hiromi has written many other books, such as The Kappa Child, Hopeful Monsters, and the young adult books, Half World and Darkest Night. Her graphic novel, illustrated by Celine Liu, is coming out in 2018. She has won many awards and served in numerous writer in residencies. 40 years ago, when I was about to come to Canada, a friend of mine said, if you're going to Vancouver, you have to look up this interesting guy named Tiger Goto. Tiger was living in Langley, and that seemed far away from Vancouver, and I forgot all about meeting him. Thirty years later, I was reading Hiromi's book, Hopeful Monsters. As I was reading, I was struck by the strong personality, the strength of character of the writer behind the short stories. Then, the name Goto suddenly clicked in my mind. I realized that Hiromi must be Tiger's daughter, the man I didn't meet. And it was really a small world. And Hiromi will be reading from her adult and young adult fictions. Okay, Hiromi-san, but the organizer said, please turn off the cell phone, please.
Hello. It's so lovely to be here, and it's I've always longingly noticed the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival. It's like, oh, that must be quite lovely. And it actually is. And it's just so marvelous to be here and to share space and story and ideas with you. And also, speaking of small worlds, thank you so much for your lovely introduction, Matsuki-san. Actually meeting people at the welcome dinner last night, there's several overlaps of kind of overlapping circles of connection with people from Langley way back in the day and other places, and it's just wonderful to see and make those connections. I'm going to read sort of samplings from several books, so a little bit of a, you know, like a tapas platter, and you can enjoy what you wish. So I'm going to read a little bit from Chorus of Mushrooms, which was written a very, very long time ago. It was my first book. And I grew up on a mushroom farm, so I spent much of my childhood into young adulthood on the mushroom farm, working my ass off. There was like no child labor stuff going on there. There's no, you know, if you're raised on a farm, you just work, and you work hard, and you get paid very, very little money. But I like to think that working on a mushroom farm in the dark and the repetitive labor, and we're talking endurance hours, sometimes we would, you know, be picking past the supper break, Because if the mushrooms have bloomed and they're ready to be picked, they have to be picked. Otherwise, they drop in grade, in quality. So you picked until it was finished. So we'd be past the supper break. You ate supper, and then you went back and picked some more. And it's, you know, on the clock is ticking away. It's almost midnight, and you're still picking mushrooms. You started at 8 a.m. But I like to think that this kind of training actually helps support the writer I am now. I think of sometimes it's not as hard at all to to write novels that it is to do the endurance mushroom picking. But it's also the kind of sense of you just need to keep on going. It's not going to be complete, and you just keep on going and going. And that kind of training actually serves me well as a writer. Course of Mushrooms is my first novel, and I started writing it when I was in my 20s, when I was taking creative writing at I was taking a creative writing course at the University of Calgary after finishing my BA in literature. And at the time, there was a lot of growing awareness and discussion about appropriation of voice, which is kind of peaked up again now. And I think it's a cyclical thing. And I don't think the quote-unquote issues of it ever go away. It's always an underlining part of social framework, which is basically a question of power. Who has power? Who has voice? Who has who occupies performance spaces? And so I think this is a discussion that comes up over and over again. And we were thinking about it then in the 90s, yes, as we think about it now. And I'll read a bit from this work. It was very much influenced by ideas of representing one's voice. Naoe. Ah, this unrelenting, dust-driven, crack-your-fingers-dry wind has withered my wits, I'm certain. Endless as thought, as breath. Not much breath left in this set of bellows, but this wind just blows and blows and blows. Soon be blowing over my mummy carcass and beetles won't find the tiniest bit of soft flesh to gnaw on serves them right. Dust in my joints, dry as rust, and I creak. Well worn I am, well worked. Can't stoop to sweep up the dust swirling in the corners of the rooms. Dust swells and eddies, motes linger to parch in my nose, my mouth. Don't bother dusting, I say. It'll come back surely. Let the piles of dust grow and mound, and I'll plant daikon and eggplant seeds. Let something grow from this daily curse. But no. Keiko just looks at me from the corners of her eyes. I know. Never mind. No matter. Just let Oba-chan sit in her chair in the hall so she can see who comes and goes. My back to the staircase, and I can see who comes through the front door. People have to pass me to get inside this house. Don't try to sneak by. I might stick out my foot. No one moves in this house without meeting my eyes, hearing my voice. Take no notice, I say. I'll try not to stare. I'll nod and smile. Welcome, welcome into this pit of dust, this bowl of heat. Ohaeri kudasai. Dozo, ohaeri kudasai. Talk loudly and enunciate. I might be stupid as well as deaf. How can they think a body can live in this country for 20 years and not learn the language? But let them think this. Let them think what they will, for they will. Sorry, Oba-chan no speak English. Maybe I'm the fool, but stubborn I am and will remain. Keiko glances at me these days more often than before with that curl of sour tofu curds lingering in her mouth. I'm not blind. I've heard the talk. I think we should start looking for an H-O-M-E, as if I can't spell. 85 years old and cast from my home. At least the dust here is familiar. Every grain, every mote, as familiar as the smell of my body. No time now to learn new dust in a new home. Let me just sit here. Let me sit here in the hall by the door. There are no windows here to torment me. I can only hear the muffled roar of the wind through the insulated walls, and I can drown out the incessant swirl of dust, of chaff, with words, little songs, and hum. I mutter and mutter and no one to listen. I speak my words in Japanese and my daughter will not hear them. The words that come from our ears and mouths, they collide in the space between us. Obachan, please, I wish you would stop that. Is it too much to ask for some peace and quiet? You do this on purpose, don't you? Don't you? I just want some peace. Just stop. Please, just stop. Gomen nasai, warui ne obachan wa. Sorry, sorry. Keiko, there is method in my madness. I could stand on my head and quote Shakespeare until I had a nosebleed, but to no avail, no one hears my language. So I sit and say the words and will until the wind or I shall die. Someone, something must stand against this wind, and I will. I am. So the first novel is about three generations of Japanese Canadian women living in southern Alberta. And the grandmother, Naoe, refuses to speak in English, although she understands it, and she learned how to speak French from Sesame Street. The mother decided that she would be assimilated and refuses to speak English, refuses to speak Japanese and will only speak in English. And the granddaughter born in Canada kind of struggles between them. She feels a strong bond with her grandmother, but they don't share language. They share a different kind of connection. So the story is mostly about the grandmother and the granddaughter. And the grandmother who had lived in the same house, in the same chair, basically, for the 20 years, decides that she's had enough and leaves. But before she leaves, she wants to visit the mushroom farm that she had never seen before. Just she could smell it now and then when the wind blew the right direction. So she stops by there. The hallway was huge, like the wet cavern of a whale. Her eyes adjusted slowly, and she could see varying shades of black, could feel the empty space around her, could almost hear the fungus hum of mushrooms growing behind closed doors. The density of moisture clung heavily to her clothes. It was much warmer than the house she had lived in, and she unbuttoned her heavy coat and shrugged it off, unwrapped her scarves and dropped them, tugged her sweater over her head, and pulled down her polyester mompe with both thumbs, taking her panties down with them, and stepped out of her winter boots, socks still inside. She stood, shoulders slightly stooped, arms dangling, her pelvic thrust forward in weak posture. She looked like an aged shrimp in silent contemplation. But for the first time in decades, moisture filled her body. Moisture rich with peat moss and fungal breath, slowly seeping into parchment osmosis of skin and hair, the blanket wet of humidity enclosing her tiny figure. Her shallow cheeks shone a little more roundly, and the loose skin where she once had breasts began to rise like bread, like manto. Her skin, so dry, slowly filled cell by cell, like a starving plant, the mushroom moisture filling her hollow body. The wet tinkling into her brittleness, blood stirring, restless, like silk threads they wound through her. Old chicken arms grew longer, filling with supple strength, her buttocks curving, swelling with flesh and longing. She could hear her body filling, the rippling murmur of muscles and bones, squeak of hair growing long and smooth, long enough to sweep the soft skin of her back, her yellow parchment skin growing taut, glowing coolly like newborn silkworms. She ran her palms from her collarbones over breasts, belly, hips, thighs, laughed aloud in wonder, stood tall and straight and stretched on her toes, flung her hands skyward. She strode down the dim hallway, the floor shaking beneath her feet. The buckets on hooks against the walls clattered with each step she took, and some fell, rolled under her feet to be squashed like styrofoam cups. She breathed in great drafts and followed the scent ripe with fungal ecstasy. She stood before a door marked number 9, stretched out a hand and pushed it inward on noiseless hinges, heard the timeless murmur of mushrooms, hush. She had to bend low, tuck her head into her chest, and enter sideways to fit her giant body through the frame of the door. And finally, she stood among them. Fast rows upon rows, beds of peat and darkly, richly wet. And mushrooms, such mushrooms, they gleamed like newly hatched silkworms, like jellyfish and oysters. The only sound, the drip, drip of moisture condensed on the ceiling, plipping into tiny puddles on the damp cement floor. Welcome, welcome into this world of moist. So I think of any work of writing and art that's shared into a public space as to be ideologically loaded artifacts, because we can't separate our form and our stories from a strong sense of our own learned ideologies. And so Chorus of Mushrooms was what I thought of as a very actively politicized text in terms of the political intentions were made transparent on the page and overtly speaking to the reader and stating itself in very direct forms. And I really, really needed to write that. I was in my 20s and, you know, growing up in Western Canada on colonized lands. But the education that I went through was very, very, you know, Eurocentric in terms of literature and all those things that we were learning in school. And so there's sort of a distorted lens through which one would see oneself in television, in other literatures, the idea of submissive Oriental woman is, you know, this kind of apparatus that has followed many Asian appearing women throughout their lives, and it's just like a long, long legacy of colonialism and Orientalism, etc. So I really, really needed to be able to speak back to how Asian Canadian women were perceived and how Asian Canadian women and Asian women and Asian bodies too are represented on the page. So Chorus of Mushroom, I thought is very political. The other texts are political too, but the thing with writing is that when you're shaping the stories, then you can bring a framework around the story in particular kinds of ways. So it's like sort of the director directing and guiding the way the camera works. And you can do that with language, with you know, a great deal of, you could have like sort of hyper-realism in terms of how things are described or illustrated on the page, or it could be comedy, or you know, or it could be, things are couched in different frameworks. That's called a mixed metaphor. However, when I first started writing, people always are making assumptions about people's genders and identities and race and sexuality, all these things. But one of the things that came up when I was, you know, in my 20s, I was like fiery, less fiery now, if you can believe it. I'm all chill. This is me chill. But a question I would often get is that, oh, like people say, what do you do? I say, I'm a writer. And say, oh, you must write for children. I'm like, I mean, I wouldn't do that because I know you're not supposed to do that. But I would think that in my thought bubble in my head. I was just like, why would you just assume that I write for children? And then I decided, and I knew it was because I was a young woman. So a young woman would write for children. I don't know why, but that was the sort of gendered assumption I had at the time. So then I thought, I'm never going to write for children. I'll show them. It was a very kind of reactive way, but it was I was in my 20s. Not to say all people in their 20s act like this. I did in my 20s. But then I had children. And then I was, again, looking for stories where the children might see representations that would remind them of themselves. And I thought back to the kinds of stories that I like to read as a child. Fantastic stories, ghost stories, horror stories, science fiction, fantasy, all of it, I loved it so much. And started looking for stories like that so my children could read them, but could not find them. There were a lot of stories. If there were stories of children of color in a Canadian context, it was kind of hinged around sort of a multiculturalism banner. So, you know, it was like either talking specifically about anti-racism or racism, or it was like some ethnic holiday. And, you know, like just like people of color in Canada are not having ethnic holidays every day. It's like you're just like doing your regular shit, you know? And also, you just want to have your own fantasies and adventures and be your own hero. It's good to be able to imagine how a person like you can be a hero. And so I decided then, I can't find these books that I want my children to read. And so I will write them myself, because it's not like they needed new teeth. And I would just like, okay, I'm gonna make you new teeth, children. Like, that wouldn't work out. But in this case, I felt like I could transfer my writing skills to writing children's books. So I wrote three books for youth and children, and Half World and Darkest Light are, it's not a, I think of them as companion books, but I wrote them trying to make it possible to read either of them without having read the other, but who knows, you can decide. Darkest Light is the second book. So you could like do an experiment and buy it and read it and see if it worked without reading the first book, which is Half World. And these two books, it was not overtly intentional in terms of trying to speak back to direct representation questions in a sort of politicized way. But it's important for me to center characters of color as the primary characters in the stories that I write. In these two, they're kind of dark fantasy. It's not fantasy like they're going off and riding unicorns and having sword fights. They're actually kind of dark. It's quite horrific at times, and kind of exploring questions of more kind of philosophical questions. In fact, in Darkest Light, often many of my stories kind of have a genesis of from a place of what if, and part of the writing of the story is to figure out the answers to the original what if question. And one of the, I'm interested in lots of various things, but looking at various stories and structures of adventure novels or stories of heroism, I'm always fascinated in the ways that we understand what is heroic behavior and what is villainy or even, what is evil? And it seems to me to be very, very strongly a binary structure, that you're either all good or all evil. And so I'm most interested in sort of the gray areas where those things overlap. Those areas are fascinating to me, like liminal sites of exploration. So for Darkest Light, I was wondering the question about having an anti-hero, and also the question of what if everything that you thought you knew about the world, it came tumbling down, and everything that you knew, thought you knew about yourself was not true. How would you return from that? How would you rebuild your idea of yourself? So I guess basically an idea of the collapse or the annihilation of the self. How do you bring yourself back from that? And also the notion of nature or nurture too. Like if you found out not only were you adopted, but your biological father was a sociopath. What would that knowledge do to your sense of yourself, your core self, and also how you would understand your own feelings? And so working through those kinds of ideas took this novel into a rather dark place. But I also think, so it's marketed as YA, but I think, you know, I wrote these books sort of also as books for everyone. I'll read an excerpt now. So G, who's been adopted by an older Chinese-Canadian woman, who's a lesbian. She's taken ill and is in hospital, and he's discovered that there are things going on he has no idea about, and that a small stone, white jade stone cat sculpture has come alive, and things are going bad. It approaches. The cat's voice was small. Weary, he sat on his haunches by G's feet. Iciness skittered down G's neck. What? He had meant to sound angry, but his voice wobbled and faded away. The unpleasant cat was staring at his paws, his tail a flat, dead thing upon the floorboards. Silence. Complete. Heavy, the very air was compressed with it. The inside of G's ears rang. A sourness rose from his maw, spreading across his tongue. He wanted to spit the foul taste out of his mouth. The cat leapt. Shocked, G was paralyzed. The cat's heavy body thudded against his chest, but his claws did not sink into his flesh. The cat's claws were sheathed, and with nothing on which to snag, his round body began sliding downward. Instinctively, G cradled his arms around the miserable creature. The old cat's long sigh ended with a little purr. Or, G thought, the heartless creature had indigestion. You must take me with you, the white cat hissed. His claws prickled against G's chest for a brief moment before they were retracted. Whatever happens, you must take me with you. Darkness comes and you are not ready, but still you must go. The cat shook his head. Ming Wei, the things I do for you. The room was cold. The room was freezing. Yet the light that slipped through the cracks of the curtains was buttery yellow. What darkness? Take you where? Tell me, G cried. The cat did not respond. His head was tilted to one side, one ear sweeping for sounds G could not hear. The thudding of G's heart filled his head. Your past, the cat finally whispered. It is your past, half world. Remember. The cat's voice was faint. Something was happening to his body. It was shifting, shimmering from fur and flesh into a different kind of matter. Your past does not have to be your future. The cat faded, almost completely transparent and weightless, before suddenly contracting. Something small and solid fell to the wooden floor with a dull clunk. A small white stone sculpture, slightly larger than a walnut, lolled from side to side before lying still. G crouched down to pick it up. The details were worn down with age and time, and all that remained were hints of pointed ears, a sweeping tail curled around the hindquarters of a crouching cat. Creak. It was the first step at the bottom of the stairway. G's heart began to thud. Slowly, steadily, each step screeched and squealed as someone began to climb the flight of stairs. "Older sister," G cried out, his voice childless, joyful. Melanie had magicked her way home somehow. She had special powers too, like the talking cat. Papa had been speaking the truth. Older sister had known when there was trouble, and she had phoned, and now she'd returned to make everything okay. The creaking continued upward, closer and closer. "Older sister," the person did not answer. Cold dankness began permeating the air, a deep, long chill that sank into the bones, aching, a waft of cold, wintry brine. It was the smell of the ocean, an icy, darkly, greenly ocean that claimed all who fell into its depths. Swish, swish, swish. The sound of the creaking boards coming ever closer could not drown out the other sound. Slightly liquid, moist, dripping, the rich, wet, pungent odor of wet kelp. G shuddered. It was not older sister, not the older sister he knew. What did he know? Maybe this was older sister, her dark secret. Everything was coming undone. The cat, he had said that it was his past coming for him. Half-world, G swallowed hard. He had wondered his whole life. Who was he? Where did he come from? What was his real name? And now his past was coming up the stairs, smelling like death. The ceiling spun a nauseatingly slow circle. Hungry, he was so intensely hungry, he wanted to vomit. Squish, slide, squish, slide. The sound stopped. It was on the other side of the door. Seeping beneath the door, it spread slowly inward, the smell of cold, wet salt staining the old wooden floor. G watched it creep into the room from the other side of the closed door, the sound of breathing like a distant tide ebbing and flowing. Thank you. Sorry, I'm trying to look at the clock back there. Is it 2:15? Close to 20 after? Okay. So should I take some questions now? Or maybe I'll take some questions. Yeah. If there are any questions, no pressure.
You are listening to Japanese-Canadian author Hiromi Goto's solo reading at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival. Questions from the audience were not mic'd, and so you will hear only the author's answers.
Question is, do I have a favorite genre and why? To write in. Oh, so ne. I guess, yeah, my favorite genre to write in is speculative fiction. And so for me, speculative fiction is a wide umbrella that contains science fiction, fantasy, horror, but also what is thought of as magic realism. So I really like to be able to write stories that start bending And stretching, often like sort of qualities of nightmare and dreams. It's exhilarating to be able to explore story in a way that's not bound by realist detail. So yeah, that's that would be my favorite. Hi.
Could you expand on your thoughts about appropriation of voice?
I guess I set myself up. I actually have I've written about appropriation of voice on my website. So if you, later you want to read about it, this is not to like skip over responding to it in a public forum. But if you go under Hiromi Goto, if you write down Hiromi Goto appropriation of voice blog, it should come up. I wrote it quite a while ago, but because I do mentor writers, I do speak about appropriation of voice, and I find it really interesting, both as a writer and a reader. Some people have this very strong knee-jerk reaction about thinking it's an either-or situation. It's either appropriation of voice and you're mindful of it and respectful of it, or it's freedom to write is being somehow curtailed or being, you know, impinged upon. And I don't think of it as an either-or situation at all. I think that those are like two different things. I think appropriation of voice is an important consideration that it behooves writers, especially when we're making stories public. Again, so tapping back to my original understanding of all texts being shared as being very politicized sites. So for one thing, there's like no rule in the universe or even nationally about anyone preventing you from writing in whatever way you would like. And so when people feel like their rights are being impinged upon, well, it's actually, no, your rights are not being impinged upon. There's no one's gonna throw you into jail because you wrote from a subjectivity not your own. So, you know, I think that kind of, I wish people can move away from that kind of knee-jerk reaction my rights are being taken away. That's one thing I think of. And I also think about sort of the broader space in terms of social power and history of power in a nation and a nation's literature and in the nation's institutions. So that would be in education, in the arts, and also media. Literature, all these things, where there are representations of people. So, I mean, stories have representations of people and cultures in a particular context. And so, for me, being Japanese, Canadian, feminist, queer, all these different ways of being in a world that informs the way I perceive the world and how people perceive me. And so then, for me, it's very important to be able to write my stories on my own terms. And so the question about power and appropriation as voice in very sort of broad ways is how much time and how much stage time has your people occupied in the nation's arts and cultures and textbooks, school books, how much stage time has that work occupied in the broader social imagination? And also, whose stories have been suppressed? And historically, many stories have been suppressed for a very long time. And so if there's particular cultures and stories that have been suppressed for a variety of political reasons, I think it'd be good for people who have occupied a position of power in terms of expressing their stories on their terms to take a step back and let the people whose voices have been suppressed take up center stage for a good while. too. And I also think of it as, and also this is a simple term too, but in terms of like a weigh scale, if you put a weigh scale of how many stories of from people of color have been published and shared, indigenous stories, queer stories, in the great weigh scale, how many stories have been sort of about from the framework of whiteness or heterosexuality, a patriarchal position, and we put it on a weigh scale. And then on the one hand would be sort of white heteropatriarchy. This is the feminist side speaking, of course. And then on the other side is the queer folks, people of color, indigenous writers, and on a sort of a grand national weigh scale, which side would be tipping heavier? I didn't make the weigh scale. So that for me is kind of a snapshot of my thinking around appropriation of voice. But I would never ever say to someone, you must not do that as a writer. My thing as a mentor or a teacher of fiction is, let's think about this very critically. Well, I think the whole purpose of writing is to explore the bounds of one's perceptions. And so I think we are always bound by the limits of our own understanding. That's just the way we are. And that it's also a lifelong endeavor to try to move beyond the limits of one's thinking as, you know, thinking human beings. In terms of Joseph Boyden, I think it's important for me to listen to the critiques of indigenous writers and indigenous scholars. I would look to them in terms of what they are saying. That's my thinking on it.
This question was about the degree of diversity available in children's literature and whether it has increased today.
I think there's a lot more understanding and discussion around it. I still think it's underrepresented, but there is more awareness and talk about it. And I think actually places like, you know, social media, Twitter, you see discussions and hashtags, we need diverse books. And that actually can capture a broader readership as well as interest from the publishers to kind of gauge what is marketable. Because on the publisher side of things, you know, they're publishing things that they think will also make money. And so there's a balance between sort of different concerns that different people bring to the table. But I do think there's a shift, and I find like there's a more discussion around it, and I find that very heartening. So fingers crossed. Yeah. Oh, sorry, there's some questions back there. Yeah.
This question is about what does a novelist's writing week look like?
Pretty lazy. Not like a mushroom picker. it depends whether or not I'm on deadline. So I'm very deadline driven. So if I don't have, like, in that, by that I mean I've signed a contract and feel very obligated to produce and there's a definite deadline, then it's just a mathematical, simple math. That's all I do. Is how many words am I supposed to produce for the project? How many days do I have left? And if I give myself weekends off, then I just divide how many words I need to do a day. It's simple math. And then I do the work. But this, the problem is when you get stuck, because I'm a pantser, and that means I don't outline. I know where the story starts. I have my characters. I have my larger sort of what if question. And I also have an end direction. But because I don't plot the entire thing out, I get stuck. So then on the days that you get stuck and write nothing, you have to add on that word count the next day. So, you know, you get really, it can get you into a bad situation. If I don't have a contract, then I can be, you know, quite unfocused of the page. I'm not writing everything. So, you know, they're like writers, famous writers who say, I write every day. I was like, I guess that's why I'm not a famous writer. I'm also like kind of philosophize my approach and say, well, part of being a writer is to also, I need to live. And that's it's like living is also my research. And, you know, that really works well for me. I think there's another question.
Yeah? Hi? My question was going to be, what's your biggest struggle, your first struggle as a writer?
What is my biggest struggle as a writer? Making enough money? That would be the biggest struggle. That having said that, though, I also feel really, really blessed because I'm doing what I want, and that not many people get to do that, or it's hard to do that. And so I feel very blessed and grateful for that. The hardest thing as a writer is, I appear to be very comfortable up here chatting, but not really. I think a lot of writers and artists are also introverts. So part of the challenge too is to be in like these very kind of social spaces. But it's also really amazing to interact too. So there's, you know, there's like pros and cons to everything. Yeah. Have I spoken for long enough? Speaking about the big weigh scale in life, yes? Which current Asian American writers do I enjoy right now? Maybe Asian Canadian more than Asian American would be Larissa Lai and Kyo McClear, Tamai Kobayashi. Those three pop up in my head immediately. Yeah. Check them out. Is that good? I'm serious. How long was I supposed to talk to you? Yeah, we're good? Yeah, okay, yay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Hiromi-san.
That was Hiromi Goto reading her work and answering questions at the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival in July 2017. Her description in the festival schedule reads, Hiromi Goto is the author of many books for youth and adults. Her writing has been honored with the Commonwealth Writers Best First Book Prize, the Japan-Canada Book Award, the James Tiptree Jr. Award, the Sunburst Award, and the Carol Brandon Parallax Award. Her first graphic novel, Shadow Life, with artist Celine Loop, will be published in 2018 with First Second Books. She is a mentor in the Writers' Studio at Simon Fraser University, an editor, and a mother. She gratefully lives and dreams on the traditional unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. Thanks to the annual Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival and to author Hiromi Goto for permission to broadcast this recording on non-commercial radio. Frieda Worden made the recording and lightly edited it for broadcast.